Life throws challenges at all of us, but how do we cope? I'm John Robbins, and on my podcast, I sit down with incredible people to ask the very simple question, how do you cope? We explore the moments that shape them and the ways they've learned to move forward. Whether it's mental health, grief, or overcoming fear, we talk about it all, honestly and openly. So if you're looking for real conversations about resilience and finding light in the dark, follow How Do You Cope? Brought to you by Audible, wherever you get your podcasts.
People that I loved wanted to reach out to me, but I just couldn't. It was this, you know, self-sabotage. All of that pulling the phone out was just a way that I went into this darkness even more. I pray that people don't have to go to that darkness, you know, and that's why I love what you're doing, you know, and bringing this awareness to people that need it and you know, that don't have to go. It doesn't have to go that far, but back then I didn't know what I know now.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholefield. In this podcast, I speak to some incredible people about mindset, mental health, addiction and recovery. And I share my own journey throughout these conversations. So whether you're on your own path of self-discovery, recovery or transformation, inspired by human stories of mental resilience, or supporting someone who is struggling with addiction, make sure you follow and subscribe to This Is Powerful. There'll be a new episode every Thursday. In these episodes, we will be talking about drug and alcohol misuse, suicide, sexual abuse, and some other heavy topics. So please take care when listening. My guest today is Sonia Gibney. With 21 years of recovery, Sonia is a thriving yoga instructor and a coach. She has such a calming presence, which is the opposite of what she would have had before she came into recovery. She shares about navigating childhood with a non-English speaking mother, growing up without a father, and struggling at school with dyslexia in the East End of London. She's dedicated to helping other women and has a wonderful insight about liberation that comes, as she puts it, to go within and you'll never have to go without. And for Sonia, that means that she will never have to be saved again by anyone, because she's learned to be her own knight in shining armour. Sonia, thank you so much for coming on This Is Powerful. I know you're a busy girl, but I appreciate your time. And congratulations, because you're 21 years sober today.
Thank you, Paul.
That's amazing. Sonia, I'd love to know more about you. So where are you from and how was your upbringing?
I grew up in Stratford, East London. My upbringing, I would say my mum was a single parent. I grew up with no education. You know, my mum done the best that she knew how. So I grew up on an estate in Stratford.
And did you, when you say about education, did you go to school and how was your school life?
Yeah, I did go to school, but I think I struggled growing up when I reflect back now. I was severely dyslexic. My mum came to this country when she was 16.
Where was your mum from?
Northern Cyprus.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so she came to this country. English at that time wasn't very good. So she done the best that she knew how. But back then, 53 years ago, a long time, she didn't pick up that I was struggling at school. And I think the whole, my mum and dad separated, I was very young, 3 or 4.
Did she speak English to you or not early on? Is that why you had problems?
Yeah,
well?
No, she did, but it was very broken. Yeah. And I think she was never educated herself, so she obviously couldn't educate me or even to let the schools know that I was struggling.
Yeah. Is your dad English?
Yeah, my dad was English. He wasn't very much on the scene, you know, maybe the odd weekend. But yeah, he wasn't really a big part of my life.
So you were struggling with education. How did you cope? Like, were you, you know, if you struggled, does that mean like everything's unhappy? Did you have good times as a youngster?
When I reflect back, I see myself as that 10-year-old. I remember queuing to go into a school disco, and at 10, I couldn't write my own name. So reading and writing, I just struggled in being able to read and write. So when, again, I reflect back on that, I could see that I was very... the schools thought I was naughty and very mischievous, but I can see that now as I was struggling. And obviously back then they didn't have the tools to be aware that obviously I had severe dyslexia. Yeah. On top of that, my mum couldn't support me. There was no support at home.
That's a good combination. not to be reading novels, yeah, by the age of 10, blimey. If you was mischievous, it's probably because you're trying to cope, right? It's like a coping mechanism. Oh. And it's easy to be the clown of the class or have fun. And
definitely. That, I mean, I could see that, you know, that was me acting out my frustration, my shame, my guilt. I didn't know that then as a 10-year-old. And I'd say that's where the whole addiction and running from began. I mean, I didn't start, you know, drinking, but I used other tools and substances, you know, life. Sweets, chocolates, escape, fantasy, you know, back then, because I suppose my reality, you know, was I didn't want to face reality. It sort of felt quite painful.
So when you say fantasy, you were just daydreaming and...
You know, I was quite a loner, and I would create these like fantasy people and talk to them. And, you know, although I love my mum dearly, you know, she was an amazing mum, I just suppose I never felt seen or heard. And the fantasy was I created my own, yeah, fantasy friends. And, you know, it was a way that I could cope of being seen and heard as a child.
Was you very sporty?
Very.
Because I found my freedom in sports.
Yeah.
What was your sports?
Oh, I was in everything. So netball, there was a running club. Boxing.
Did you box?
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
Seriously?
Yeah.
What, through the school or outside?
Outside of the school. But I was very much a tomboy. So yeah. I tend to gravitate more to guys because I think as well I was quite an angry child and I had this built up anger. Yeah, I've always been sporty and I think that was my strength and people. I've always been good at you know, communicating and having these friendships, sort, yeah, of. I was quite a, well, you know, they say now people pleaser, but I was really good at...
Probably a social bunny, actually.
Yeah, yeah, I was.
When you say about addiction with sugar, because I guess sugar's a massive one for people, isn't it? What was the sensation you got when you had sweets and different sugars as a kid? What was the change in you?
Oh, you know, it was... I knew, but... You know, at that 10-year-old, that sweets were, you know, gave me this high, you know, that I loved that how it made me feel, you know. So I obviously was quite, even then at 10 years old, had this addiction to sugar, to that, mm-hmm, that high, that rush that it gave me.
Does sugar still come into your life?
The whole thing for me was managing my emotions, and that's where, even back then, where I'd say my addiction started, I wasn't able to, I didn't know what emotions were, so I wasn't able to manage them. Where today, I'm able to, I'm aware of it. So like you just said, wealth and well-being is a part of my life. So yes, obviously I love, you know, cakes and I love sugar, but I know it's not good for me. And I actually now today, I don't actually like that high, even I'd say with caffeine. I'm able to now regulate my nervous system and I know what works and what doesn't work. So that high and then that low, that crush, it doesn't feel, you know, good in my body. So yeah, I'm able to sort of know what's right and what's not.
How did you get into alcohol and drugs? At what point, how did that materialise in your life? And was you aware of that early on, that that could be an issue?
No, so I wasn't aware of it at all. Going back, so I grew up on this estate, and I must have been 13, 14, and I loved music, and it was sort of then the rave scene, the clubbing and dancing. I was still underage, but there was a local little bar that I dressed up and made out I was older that I could get into. So it started off really with not even drinking. It was more puffing, hanging out, you know, around the estate that I grew up. Then I got into this bar, then when alcohol started. I didn't know it was a problem. But what started to become a problem was I started to black out and not known, you know, where I'd been, how I got home. The real problem started when I started to lose me, started to lose my identity of who I was, started to have anxiety and this overwhelming of fear just about everything.
But the rave scene, we were talking about before with our last guest, the rave scene was a really good time, I felt, for me anyway, because it was a kind of unity of people that come together. And it was around dancing and music.
Yeah.
It wasn't a dark time, it was a light time, wasn't it? How was that for you in that period?
I mean, I loved it. I loved that freedom of dance and love and peace, you know. I love the whole community still to this day, you know, with yoga, and I love community. I love recovery, how you come together, and it's that community. I wish it would have just stopped there, but it didn't, because that freedom and that community that I loved, it didn't end up like that, you know. It ended up where I was alone, drinking on that anxiety, you know, frightened to leave the house. It started to affect my self-esteem. You know, I started to feel really, with all of that shame as that 10-year-old, that all started to creep back in, you know, that I started to feel I wasn't good enough, you know, that I started to compare myself, what I've achieved and I hadn't achieved. And it just started to eat me away. So then my using became, towards the end, where I was at home. I remember I got signed off of work for probably about 3 months.
So what were you doing actually for
so
work?
Before I became a yoga teacher and a coach, I was always into fashion, and I love fashion. But when I reflect back now, because I grew up with no education, I was very good at selling. So it was just an easy, you know, thing for me to get into. But when I sort of reflect back now and see, the fear became so overwhelming, and the hangovers and the dread and the fear of going into work and then actually dealing with clients.
Like in the sense of like a personal shopper to suggest what they should put on and what's good for them. And,
Because
it's quite a personal.
Yeah, it was very personal, because people look to me to make them feel good on the outside in what they, you know, of what they wore. And they're looking to me, and I'm meant to make them feel good about themselves, and I'm feeling, you know, crap and shit about myself, wanting to die on the inside, but putting this mask on the outside that I'm okay, and I wasn't okay.
Becomes quite painful, doesn't it? Because you're living a dual life really at the time.
Well, you know, now 21 years on, it's quite accepted, you know, in the world that we live in now, not to drink. But back then it was, you know, as if I was weird, or, you know, you don't drink, you know, how comes? And so it was a very hard time. God, the amount of times it's like, what do you do for fun? You know, and it's like, today, what do I do, you know, for fun? I can actually say, I feel like I'm living my life. I'm living my best life. You know, like I said, I love movement. I love dance. I've just come back from, you know, a dance festival. But in the beginning, you know, the truth, that wasn't comfortable for me. I didn't do that until I was about 4 years sober.
Yeah.
But today, the freedom and the joy, because I'm present, I'm sober, I'm alive, I can actually hear and feel the music, where back then, God, you know, I wasn't never present. And that is, for me, the biggest gift, you know, sobriety has given me, that I'm present today.
Yeah, it's powerful. It's powerful to say. So you started to get anxiety, difficulty at work, probably feeling like imposter syndrome. Mm. And you said that you started to feel like you were when you was 10. Did you know that consciously you started to feel like what you were at 10, or you just started to feel odd and not right?
Yeah, no, I didn't know that consciously that I was feeling that 10-year-old. But without doing any work, it was that 10-year-old, them feelings of shame and not feeling good enough and feeling worthless, and, you know, it haunted me. You know?
Was there a moment or a time during drinking and partying before then that you thought, shit, I'm losing control here, or this is getting a bit too much?
I remember being in my ex-partner's house. And I remember calling my mum because I was in a depression. And I asked my mum to bring me a bottle of wine. And she couldn't read or write. So she said, which one? And I said, when you get there to the off licence, just call me and let me speak to the guy. Because I wanted the highest volume of the wine, the alcohol. Yeah. And I remember my mum coming to the house and knocked on the door, and I took the wine and I shut the door on my mum's face. And I knew then, you know, that things weren't good. I didn't leave the house for days. I stopped washing. I used to pull the phone out of the wall because I knew loved ones and friends. I had the conversation with a friend this morning about that how she called me to say how proud she is of me. And she said, do you remember when I used to call you and say, don't pull that phone out, because I wasn't in a good place. And that makes me sad, you know, of how it had to get to that before I, you know, started my journey.
Ooh, I remember pulling the phone out of the wall. Probably the last year of being in trouble, I would change I bought loads of locks, and I would change them every 3 weeks, month, whenever, so that no one could come into my place as well. Sad, isn't it?
Yeah, really sad. And, you know, at the time... When I think back now, I thought that, you know, the house that I live in at that time, you know, externally, I still tried to manage my life, that my life was all okay. It was like being in a prison, yeah, in my own home, you know. People that I loved wanted to reach out to me, but I just couldn't. It was this, you know, self-sabotage of this, I thought, what was depression, you know, all of that, pulling the phone out was just a way that I went into this darkness even more. But I'm a great believer in, you know, I hope and I pray that people don't have to go to that darkness, you know, and that's why I love what you're doing, you know, and bringing this awareness to people that that need it and you know, that don't have to go. It doesn't have to go that far. But back then, I didn't know what I know now.
After that period, how long was it before you came into sobriety?
So it wasn't long after that, really. I told my ex-partner, and it's funny because I don't think that he thought I had a problem. I don't think anyone thought I had a problem.
Is that because you kept up appearances really well, that you wanted to show that you was fine?
Partly that, but partly as well, drinking was just so acceptable. And it was, I was at home, I wasn't harming anyone, I was maybe having dinner, having a bottle of wine, but then, and as well, the excuse that I'm depressed, you know, so that was acceptable. Well, I'm depressed, so I can drink, but it was adding to my depression. So I sort of admitted to my ex and to my mum, I still didn't know I had a problem, but I knew that I had depression. I was clinically, the doctor diagnosed me. I was on antidepressants and still drinking on them, although I was told not to. So they didn't work. I then went into the Priory for depression, not for my drinking.
Did you just say to your partner at the time, your mum, this is where I need to go? Or was that, how did that journey start?
So at the time, when I look back now, God, my ego was up here. So I thought I was actually going to a spa, if I'm really, really brutally honest.
That's what I did.
I didn't think I was going into a mental home, you know. So I basically thought, okay, this would be a great idea for me to go to the Priory, a little getaway, saunas, steam. So that's what I thought. So I told my ex that... that I wanted to go there. I needed help for my depression. So I went there, and obviously they, I never forget, I was wearing a cap. I was not good at eye contact. I always wore this cap. And even on the way there, mum come with me and we stopped off for lunch and I had a bottle of wine. I can laugh about it, but it's not funny.
That's exactly what I did on the way in.
Yeah. So had the bottle of wine, gone there, they knew. Soon as I turned up there, they knew I had a problem. So they said about a 28-day program. So I'd said yes.
So did you say yes, like, yes, because I need help, or you just wanted a respite from your life?
A respite from my life. And I actually, if I'm, again, saying about the ego, I was like, do you know where I'm going? You know, I come from the East End and now I'm going to the Priory. So obviously... wasn't mentally well, because I thought, oh, you know.
He's going up a step.
Yeah, I'm going, exactly. Like, I'm going to this spa. Have you not seen all the celebrities that are in this spa? So I was definitely, bless me, back then I wasn't well. But, you know, it got me well.
Yeah.
And I remember the first day that I was meant to go to the Priory, told my mum and my ex-partner that I did not want them to take me there, that I wanted to go alone. So I remember driving, thinking, on my way there, I'm going to stop off and get some essentials. So I got some candles. But that didn't stop there with the candles. I remember calling my dealer. So I picked up some coke. I went to Canary Wharf to a few bars, had a few drinks. And I remember driving to the Priory, but just before I got there, there was a pub. So I thought it would be a good idea, pull up there before I get there. So this is the insanity of alcoholism.
Yeah.
You know, when I speak about that now, I'm like, and you thought you didn't have a problem? Because that's not normal drinking. And stopped, had a drink there. Got to the Priory, but obviously I'd had substances on me, so I threw them out. I'd gone in, realised the windows were bolted down, thought the people in there were like nutters. What am I doing here? So I basically left. went back downstairs, picked the substances up and went back to the pub.
No way.
Yeah.
Did they just let you walk out?
Yeah. I then got a call from my ex and my mum, and they asked where I was, and I said, oh, I'm on my way. So I thought, I'm best to get back up there. So I did. I went back up there. They then took my car keys and all my possessions, and that's when.
Well, that was good.
Yeah. And that's when it all started.
I used to throw stuff away because I thought, I can't do it anymore. I don't want any more. And then 20 minutes later, I'll be searching for it.
Mm.
Sad, isn't it?
Oh, God. I've done that with all sorts. Cigarettes. Thought, oh, I don't want to smoke it. Can't, you know, chuck them in the bin. Next day, I'm rooting in the bin to get them out. So, again, but it's for that to change the way that I feel, you know. And in that moment when I chucked them or that, my intention was to stop. I don't want this anymore. But then that obsession had kick in and I'm in the bin.
Yeah, that's powerful. That's the thing about obsession. It's powerful. Mm. It's an overriding thought that goes above any other thought, isn't it?
Mm.
In there, did they work on you for alcohol? How did it come around that you realised you need to be sober?
Yeah, so obviously the 28-day program was for my drinking. So although I was depressed, they were saying that the depression was just a symptom of my alcoholism.
Gotcha.
So I was like, okay. So I was there. I was actually there longer than 28 days. I was actually there 31 days. So then they went through a whole program, you know, of my drinking. If I'm really honest, when I look back now, I was still sort of thawing out. I didn't really sort of get it. I got taken to meetings. Again, I loved that because I loved the community. I loved, you know, people sharing and that support. But I still didn't really get the extent of my whole addiction.
So I remember seeing you, I hold my hands up in a meeting there.
Yeah.
I remember saying to you, I thought you was really amazing and you was really attractive. But then I remember you saying about we need to put our program first before anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And that was probably such an amazing lesson for me because I was so new in and I didn't understand dynamics of the healthy stuff around recovery.
Do you know, I'm so grateful to Paul that was put in place. You know, there's many times when I look back now that I'd gone to meetings because there was someone there that I was attracted to, that I got there. But it was suggested to me, you know, not to get in any relationships the first year. And I'm so glad that was, you know, it's a suggestion, but I took that on board because getting sober was, you know, one of the hardest things that I ever had to do. And I didn't know how to deal with these emotions. So getting into a relationship with all those emotions when I'm just pouring out and, you know, trying to get to know me.
One of the therapists in the Priory said to me, she said, you know, when you've come in to recovery, which means you put down all the substances you would have used and the behaviours you would have used before, to suppress any shame or not look at yourself. The inside, you carry all that anyway, so it's there.
Mm.
So you're either going to literally go in and rearrange all of your confusion or your suppression or trauma, or whatever it is, work on it, and then you'll be free from it. Yet all the behaviours of relationships and stuff suppress that.
Mm.
So you go into a relationship with all your baggage, repeat the same process, cause a drama, it's not going to work. And then you leave and do the same pattern again. And for me to break a cycle like that was incredible. I really got to know who I was, cried many times at night, felt incredibly lonely. But it's because I didn't want to be with myself. Mm. When I accepted that I could be with myself, started enjoying my company, which is very weird for me.
Mm.
You know, and I think that's a powerful lesson to learn in recovery, right?
Oh, very powerful, very inspiring, I think. You know, on our journey and going to meetings and that fellowship, that gave me that. You know, I know with yourself going out for coffees after the meetings and having that community gave me that strength as well, where I could be attracted to somebody, but I knew that this, I'd committed to myself that I wanted to have this relationship and actually take that time out to get to know me. And like I said back then, the same with the chocolate, I would have fixed on anything to change the way that I felt, you know. So if someone was attracted to me, I knew deep down in my heart it was a way of me escaping me again. And I knew that I'd committed to me for the first time in my life, you know, and I knew that I wanted to stick with that, you know. And it's not always easy. It can be very lonely, but it's so, so worth it. You know, it's so, when I look at it now and I look at the woman that I am today, I can be attracted to certain people. But I look at today as well of where back then I didn't know what I wanted. I didn't know, you know, if you was good looking, or I didn't know what qualities, because I didn't actually have them qualities within myself. But through going through the program and doing that inner work, you know, the woman that sits here today, I'm able to say, you know, that I like myself. I know what I want today. And one thing that people that know, I will never settle, you know, just to have someone in my life that I can't sit with myself today.
Such a powerful thing you said about escaping yourself. And I remember someone saying to me, I said, oh, I'm going to go to LA again. I'm going to move back there and get a house. And they said, that's fine, but you're still taking yourself. I thought, what do you mean by that? You know, and then when I arrived there, I got a lovely house and stuff. And I remember laying there on my bed thinking, yeah, I've still got my thoughts. I'm still with me. So you can fool yourself by surrounding yourself with shiny things. But unless you go inside and change your narrative and change what's going on, nothing else, nothing will work.
There's a great thing that I say, go within and you'll never go without. So it's a journey inwards. And yeah, there's another, what is it? You take your head with you. You know, I've been to myself many places and been in relationships, but like what you just said, Paul, the thoughts and the feelings, you know, of what I'm feeling, that no human power is ever going to be able to rescue me. You know, I'm the only person that can rescue me, that can do this work.
How did the journey into yoga come around?
So I took some time off from fashion and I went traveling to do my teacher training.
Where did you go for that?
So I went to Tuscany.
Not a bad spot.
Yes. Or it was a life-changing, because it was literally in the mountains, no social media, no internet. There was one Carrezzo, a little village that had internet, and I was only allowed to go there once a week. You got a day off. I suppose, like when I went into the Priory, I was taken away. This was another level of my journey where I'd done that inner work. And yeah, I was there for 5 weeks. I transitioned from fashion into yoga. I love the way that it makes me feel, how it calms my nervous system.
Can you tell me about the spiritual stuff in yoga?
Yeah.
And how does that relate to like a recovery program?
So for me, when I said go within, so it regulates the sympathetic nervous system. So when obviously my nervous system was shattered. So being able to regulate that through breath, so basically it takes you out of the mind and into the body. So I'm able then to connect, to still and calm my nervous system. So through breath, through meditation. So although it's quite a physical, yoga can be quite physical, I think my practice is more about the spiritual side of it.
It must be amazing for your clients, because you've genuinely done the work in a different program and in yoga. How do you see that in them? Because there is a point of just understanding the outside, and then when you start to feel yourself and what's inside, what have you found with clients?
Well, I found I've been given a gift. I think when I look back now as well, going back to the education and my reading, that I can still struggle with today. It's given me a gift and a tool that I can work with clients, because I'm really good at connecting with people's energy of where they're at. So I feel that through the yoga and also now through my coaching, I can pick up on their energy and their body language. So I'm a great believer that all of the clients that I feel I've been blessed with, that I'm able to work with them on a deep cellular level. So not just on the physical, to be able to, because right, we live in a world that it's a busy world with emails, you know, constant. So to really, we're either in this fight and flight, you know, or rest and digest. So I'm able to bring, you know, my clients into that rest and digest, just take them out of that busyness, you know, of their life, of their mind, and just bring them into that consciousness.
Also, I think there's a little talent going on here with dyslexia, because you don't sit in front lobe. You're in your body and you see different patterns and different routes, right? And probably are more sensitive to someone's energy. That's my experience.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's, I'm very, I can pick up on energy. And I always say energy doesn't lie. I think if you would have met me 21 years ago, God, my energy was like, people that talk to me now say I've got quite a calming nature about me. But you wouldn't have said that 21 years ago. So obviously, whatever, you know, the yoga, recovery, it's obviously working. And I can sense that around people that are without any judgment, you know. But I can sense if someone's in that fight and flight, you know, if there's any dis-ease. And my job is to bring ease. You know, I know what that feels like to be in your head, to feel dis-ease, to feel disconnected, to feel full of fear. So that's why I believe my job, I love what I do today.
Do you think there's a difference between guys and girls in recovery, like coming into the journey?
So I really, for me, I always share this, you know, I take my hat off to guys, because I think guys, it's that ego thing of being vulnerable, you know. And for me, vulnerability is the biggest strength that, you know, that one could have. So when I do see guys breaking down and being vulnerable, you know, hats off to them. You know, it's very inspiring to me. When I see women, in recovery, you know, more for I'd say on the self-esteem side of things, I see that they struggle trying to fit in, that comparison, not feeling good enough, and using, like what we said, the alcohol relationships to mask that. But there's this, for myself, what I see is there's this need to be rescued. So any women that I talk to, or that I help today, it's always about getting them to the root of what the core of their problem is, you know.
How is it now to be a woman who doesn't need to be rescued?
Oh, great place to be, Paul. Looking back, wanting to be rescued, always looking, my dad was never there. You know, my dad died of alcoholism 6 years ago. So I always looked, and growing up from the East End, really, I always got in relationships where I thought they're going to take care of me, my knight in shining armour. It's going to make my world, you know, a better world. And I know today that to put that pressure on any human being, I just wanted the quick fix. I didn't want to do the work, you know, but the only way through, the woman that's sitting here today, I had to go through that work. And you know, I can sit here now and say I'm really proud of myself, but it wasn't always easy. I can look back now and see that there was periods where I didn't want to be alone. I didn't want to face those feelings again. But in order to grow, I had to be able to let those go and to fill that void and those feelings.
If somebody is struggling with addiction or alcoholism or someone around them, what advice would you give to that person?
My biggest message would be, you don't have to hit that rock bottom, you know. You don't have to hit that darkness. There's so much on offer now. There's, you know, your podcast, there's meetings, you know, I know there's the AA hotline, you know, you don't have to suffer alone. There's so much on offer. And as I sit here now, you know, it gives me a great honour. I look back 21 years today and I never imagined that I would be sitting here, you know, sober with a life. I remember them saying a life beyond my wildest dreams, but it truly is a life beyond my wildest dreams. And, you know, if anyone's struggling, I know you're going to put my my details, please, you know, if there's any women that get something from this today, then reach out. I'll always be more than happy to help.
Thank you, Sonia.
Thank you.
This Is Powerful is brought to you by Stride Foundation. If you or someone you know is struggling with addiction, please head over to www.stridefoundation.com, where you can find links to resources that may help. You can also donate. Please make a donation. It will help us bring to you more episodes. Please rate, follow, and subscribe to the show. Why? This will help the algorithm make us more visible to others who need help. And share this podcast with your family, friends. Head over to social media at Paul Scholfort and at @this_is_powerful. You'll get to see what's coming up. And you can get in touch with us because I love hearing about you. Thank you also to my beautiful wife, Dr. Federica Amati, the best producer, Shannon Delwich, to Eber Long, who does all the hard work in the background. Thank you also to Giulia Ciccolella, Ria Musa, and the rest of the team. Did you know also you can watch us on YouTube? Just search for This Is Powerful with me, Paul Scholfort. Hi, everybody. I'd really love to hear your views so that we can produce a podcast with the content that matters to you. It doesn't matter if you just joined us or if you've been listening from the start. We would love you to fill in the short listener feedback form, which you can find in the show notes. And let me know your thoughts on our podcast. It would really mean a lot. Thanks, guys.